This is the Blaze Radio on demand.
As a guy who learned the hard way how important proper nutrition is on your health and the great harm excess weight can have on your health, I urge you to get serious about your health with SimpleToLose.com. Diets don't work, and you're really only going to be successful losing weight when you learn how to eat differently. And that is why the free health coaches at Simple to Lose are so helpful. They teach you how to eat six meals a day and why it works. Many people on my team are working with Simple to Lose and their health coaches. As a team, we've lost over 850 pounds. Mary has lost over 85 pounds and wants to live a long life to keep her family strong. Brad's lost 40 pounds, finally feels like he did when he was in his 30s. Chris, whose father died young due to obesity, has lost 100 pounds and is off most of his medications. Change your life, get healthy, and thrive today. Go to SimpleToLose.com today, not tomorrow. Go today. SimpleToLose.com.
Results do vary. Typical weight loss is 2 to 5 pounds per week for the first 2 weeks, then 1 to 2 pounds per week thereafter.
Now, spreading freedom across the nation, this is 3, 2, 1.
The Buck Sexton Show.
Oh, yes, indeed, Team Buck. Thank you so much for joining. Rocking and rolling here in the Freedom Hut today. Always excited to have you as part of the team. Team Buck, as it's known. Team Buck, as its renown spreads, not just across the country, across the globe. We've got people all over the place. Speaking of across the globe, or maybe global implications, the president has announced, or at least his people have announced on his behalf, that he's passed along to the UN what the U.S. end of climate change 2015 is going to be. Now, the White House has their climate action plan. That's how they branded it. That's back in 2013. Climate action plan. They're going to take action on the climate. Yeah, because, you know, greenhouse gases and trying to recycle and use renewable energy and solar power. It just, to me, it like might as well be a Chuck Norris movie. It's just action, man. They're taking action on climate change. But this is part of a much larger agenda. There's the progressive triad that I believe President Obama, or I guess you could think it's a three-pronged stool, President Obama has very clearly addressed and acted on, for lack of a better word, amnesty, healthcare, climate change. Now, of course, healthcare was number one. They went with healthcare first, with Obamacare. And despite all the lawsuits and all the changing of the law by executive fiat, all that stuff, the law still exists, and it still has at its premise the right of government to essentially determine what the healthcare market is and also to decide what's fair for people, how much they have to pay versus what their subsidy will be. It is a giant scheme for the redistribution of wealth. So that's on healthcare. And we know they accomplished that. When the president had both houses of Congress on his side, that was what he decided to go for. And amnesty was next, right? Because the short term. So you let government take control of healthcare, and therefore you enlarge the state and the bureaucracy to such a point where people don't really have a choice anymore but to just think about how they can change the way the government functions with the delivery of healthcare and everything else. We're just haggling over the cost, not actually discussing what the market should look like, what choice looks like within healthcare and all of that. Essentially outlines the debate for us and really means that there isn't a meaningful debate. It's just like it is in many European countries, a question of talking about, well, how much do we have to raise taxes to pay for the subsidies, to pay for the crap healthcare we're forcing on people, for example. Then you have the amnesty issue, very clear and straightforward effort to subvert U.S. law. And we're going to get into how, by the way, this is working within the bureaucracy in just a few minutes, but they're trying to subvert U.S. law. They're also doing this as really a naked power grab for votes. This is just brute force politics. We can't win a national election, or we can't win the elections by the margins we think we should, or whatever the case may be. Don't try to appeal to more voters. Just create more voters. Voters who are disproportionately dependent on government largesse and voters who are going to be, generally speaking, voting for the party of multiculturalism and an enormous federal government to support and propel them. So that's a pretty clear and straightforward progression. But now we're at the climate change part of the issue. Now we're at climate change. And I have to say that this is one that we've known is coming for some time, and that the president on this issue sees that this is his time is very clear, because in the past they've had efforts. The Democrats have made these efforts to try to get something through the Congress, right? They wanted to legislate on the issue, but then they realized that that's actually a very difficult proposition. And didn't really want to be held accountable for cap and trade, for example. They didn't really want to be held accountable for passing laws that deal with this much overhyped and an issue that forces people to hyperventilate, really. People just freak out when it comes to climate change. Otherwise, seemingly rational people all of a sudden turn into the equivalent of, you know, the Incas or the Aztecs in the 16th century or something, who are just, you know, about to freak out themselves because the sun has disappeared behind the moon for a minute or something. I mean, they just completely lose their minds. So this is now, I think, a moment where we can see what the president really wants to do, and that he's going around Congress once again. He's actually made that something of a not just a pastime, but he thinks it's now a selling point. I'm going to go alone. I'm going to go around the Congress. I don't need them. I'm going to do what I want to do. I'm going to take action. I'm going to do a thing. All this stuff. He boasts about it. He's not sheepish. He doesn't say, I know that it sort of tears at the fabric of the separation of powers. I know that there are some issues with all this, but I feel that on this one issue, it's worth maybe tearing at the fabric of the Constitution a little bit, because this is so essential. We can't wait, right? The false urgency of right now. But in fact, the president now just does this as a matter of course. You see, when the Congress was in Democrat hands, it was sacrosanct, and it was the will of the people, and President Obama was just enacting the will of the people via the Congress. But now that the Congress is very solidly in Republican hands, which is always ignored now by all these Democrat clowns who go on TV as talking heads, and, oh, well, the Republicans are never going to win another national election. And if Republicans don't do this, they're never going to win another national election. I mean, this is the height of stupidity. Anybody who goes on TV and says that at this point, you know, just either is a blatant and glib falsifier, or just doesn't know even the most recent and basic history of this country, which is that, of course, we have election swings in both directions, and there seems to be a pretty clear trend of both sides having their moments in the sun, and both sides having their periods when, oh, no, they're never going to win another election. It's just not the case, at least not unless some massive structural changes happen. Amnesty could actually be the nail in the coffin of the Republican Party. And Obamacare, fully enacted, will make it very hard for there to be a party within our government system that's truly about, or at least espouses and aspires towards, limited government. That'll probably go away too. But climate change is the final act of this administration. This is the third act of the play. This is what they've been waiting to do, what the president's been waiting to do, because there is some degree of insanity at work here. As I've said to you before, climate change is a religion for people who think they're too smart for religion. They think that a bunch of scientists are going to give them cover for, one, being completely ignorant about these topics, but also for their completely hyperbolic belief in how, if we don't all take individual action as prescribed by the government, because, you know, experts and all that are at the top of it, the planet's going to melt and we're all going to die. This is what they think in different variations and iterations, but that's actually what they're trying to say, is that at some point, we're all going to die. The planet will be uninhabitable. They will say these things out loud. And you've had, for example, in the past, President Obama even say that the greatest threat in the future facing both America and the world at large is climate change. Bigger than, bigger than nuclear war, bigger than pandemic disease, bigger than any number of things. The greatest threat facing the planet is climate change. They think this is an existential issue. See, that's why it's so important. You've got to understand, on other issues, we may have areas of disagreement. On other things, you could say, well, I think that healthcare should be X or Y. And there are big implications to that. But no matter how acrimonious that debate gets, at least the other side has to be operating within the realm of we all do want healthcare, right? I mean, at the end of the day, we all do want to have access to good doctors and everything else. They may be totally wrong about how we get there. They may think I'm totally wrong, you're totally wrong about how we get there. But at least we do want the same things. On climate change, it's actually they believe without any rational reason for this. They believe that the other side is just so stupid that they don't want to live anymore, that we want the planet to go away, that we don't care about the earth that we live on. I mean, that's their position, which is completely both bizarre and insane. And this is not a fringe belief. This is the belief of the president of the United States. Climate change deniers, the term deniers, explicitly used to link those who say, is 1 degree of warming, which is historically stretching back for centuries, is 1 degree of warming, which normal, by the way, is that something that we should all be completely up in arms about and deciding to cast off and cast away trillions of dollars of productivity and enormous amounts of freedom in our day-to-day lives because of 1 degree warming? Is that really, that's really what you want us to do? That's really the belief? President Obama would say yes, that's what they want. Because even if they're wrong, it allows them to create a more orderly society, don't you see? See, President Obama said not long ago that the best scientists in the world are all telling us that our activities are changing the climate. And if we do not act forcefully, we'll continue to see rising oceans, longer, hotter heat waves, dangerous droughts and floods, and massive disruptions that can trigger greater migration, conflict, and hunger around the globe. Climate change is essentially not just the end of the world, but it's the cause of all the world's problems. This is crazy talk. And by the way, this whole thing about longer heat waves and wetter wet seasons, drier dry seasons, colder cold seasons, hotter. I mean, this is completely disconnected from reality. And there's actually no evidence that they can point to for any of this. This is just now extrapolation based off the general data that they have, that they manipulate, as we know, that says that the Earth is going to get warmer because of CO2 in the atmosphere. Okay. Really? Well, as we know, CO2 is also what plants need for life, and that's a whole separate issue, I suppose. But they believe this stuff. They think that this is the biggest threat that faces the world. You've got Prince Charles, one of the royals in the UK. I can't believe these people actually still exist, in a sense. They're still a monarchy. But he says that the climate change agreement that President Obama is now saying he's going to sign on to with the UN, specifically, by the way, trying to exempt it from congressional approval. Climate change is going to be addressed via an international body that we don't actually have any say in, really, we the American people. So he's going not just around the Congress, but he's going to the international community for this. You have Prince Charles saying that this agreement that Obama wants to get involved in should be a new Magna Carta for the Earth and humanity's relationship with it. You cannot say anything that is too grandiose. You cannot say anything that is too crazy about climate change. They believe it all. And now President Obama thinks that the Congress is irrelevant and he should just be able to go and bind us into regulations and treaties that will have, well, not a treaty, though, because that needs Congress, that will have massive implications for our economy and our wealth and our freedom going forward. It's just crazy. We're talking about uncertain things right now, and we know the world is a very dangerous place, especially when the climate change crazies are at the controls. So many of you need, or many of you understand, rather, the need to stockpile food against the next crisis or natural disaster. When it comes to feeding your family in an emergency, you don't want to stockpile the wrong foods or risk that the food that you have stockpiled will spoil and go bad. That's why I like the Patriot Pantry brand of survival food. They are delicious, nutritious meals. They are rated for 25 years of storage. I'd like you to try today some for yourself for free. Go to freefoodnumber1.com, freefoodnumber1.com. Again, that's freefoodnumber1.com. BlazeRadioNetwork.com.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, the Blaze Radio Network.
Are you looking to save 50, 60, even 70% on your phone bill? Well, here's a tip. BroadVoice.com. Hi, it's Brad Staggs of Blaze TV here. BroadVoice offers high-quality phone service for only $8.95 a month. You may ask, how can I save so much money? What's the catch? Well, the secret is the technology. BroadVoice uses VoIP technology that takes analog audio signals from your phone, turns them into digital data, and then transfers them over the Internet. This means crystal clear sound and cheaper phone bills. BroadVoice has been ranked in the Deloitte Technology Fast 500 and Inc. 500 as one of the fastest-growing private companies in America. Get BroadVoice right now for only $8.95 a month. Keep your existing phone number for free, and BroadVoice will send you their easy plug-in adapter free. All this, and you get unlimited local calling for just $8.95 a month. Plus, for a limited time, BroadVoice will even give you your first month free. Do what we did here at Blaze Radio. Make the switch today at BroadVoice.com or call 888-332-8036. 888-332-8036.
What team are you on? Get your Team Buck shirt now at TheBlaze.com.
So immigration enforcement is a very sort of haphazard situation now, right? Because the president decides some immigration laws don't count anymore. But we do have a pretty large Customs and Immigration Service. We've got a lot of Border Patrol agents, and they are catching people at the border. But, you know, they're also catching people 100 miles interior of the border, or at least they're setting up checkpoints ostensibly to catch people from those areas. So they're well into the interior of the United States. So if you're a U.S. citizen, you're driving around minding your business, you may come upon a Border Patrol checkpoint. And some have put up videos of their interactions with Border Patrol there. And Thomas Sawyer, who's a 26-year-old trucker from Central Texas, and this was from the Houston Chronicle, he's one of them. He was at a checkpoint near Falfurrias, and he said he was going to opt out of talking about his immigration status. I'm going to walk you through how that went. Here's the initial exchange with the officer. Play that clip.
Dude, I'm too old for this. How you doing?
How's it going?
Hold on. Let me get up there first and I'll talk to you. United States citizen, sir? Yes?
I'm going to opt out.
Well, the thing is, before we can proceed with immigration inspection, if you are, that's fine. I don't really care if you're German or whatever, but are you legally in the United States?
I'm not answering questions.
Okay, then we have to go ahead and take you in. I know you're recording. We'll take you in, identify you, and then you can proceed.
So you're detaining me?
Yes, sir.
So he says, I don't want to answer the question. He obviously opposes and does not think it's constitutional for him to be stopped and to have to. Now, this is very interesting. I've said to you before, I know this. I have had, when I say law enforcement, I mean, you know, beat cops. All right, I have a beat cop in my family. And I can tell you also, having worked in the NYPD, that cops can come up to you and talk to you. People always think, oh, the cop came up to me and I said, I don't have any drugs on me. So because he came up and talked to me, that doesn't count. No, the cops can talk to you, but they also can't stop you and force you without some cause to talk to them, right? That you can say, you can just keep walking along your way. You don't have to engage. Now, this, though, is a situation where you've got federal law enforcement officers who have set up this checkpoint, which starts to get into a different area. But you can see how this is going here. It gets quite a bit worse. Play the next clip.
The search part is not a search. I'm just asking you a simple
question.
Why
am I being detained?
Because we're asking a question. Are you in United States?
I don't have to answer that. You understand? I don't have to answer the questions.
Yes, you do.
No, I don't.
Then I'm going to ask you two questions.
If I'm breaking the law, then arrest me.
Oh, you will be detained.
Okay. Arrest me then if I
break
the law.
You're being detained.
He is being detained. A bit of a back and forth here over the constitutionality of this whole situation. And I think many of you know where this is going. Predictably, given the nature of particularly Border Patrol and that side of law enforcement, they have a lot of leeway and often like to use it. He ends up getting his window smashed and dragged out of his vehicle. Play that clip.
I'll count you three and I will break this glass.
Don't break the glass, man.
One,
shit.
Open the door. Two.
I haven't done anything wrong.
Open the door. Open the door.
I haven't done anything wrong.
Open the door.
I'm not breaking any laws.
Open the door.
Man,
I don't want to break the glass.
Don't do it, man. It's not even my truck.
I know. Well, then open the door.
Man, this is absurd. I can't believe you would do this.
I will. Open the door. It's not the first one I've done.
I bet, but I've not broken any laws.
Then open the door, sir.
I've not broken any laws, man.
How many times do I have to repeat myself? Open the door.
I don't want to get out of the truck. I haven't broken any laws.
You haven't broken this law, sir.
No, I haven't. No, I haven't.
Go ahead.
I haven't broken any laws.
Open the door.
I've complied as much as I need to.
Stand back.
No.
Stand back.
There you go. Window smashed. Window smashed, and now they're reaching in, and a bunch of agents grab him and drag him out of the vehicle. Cal, we can stop the clip. This is border enforcement, apparently 100 miles inland in the United States. But just keep in mind that irrespective, there's so much we could talk about here. The constitutionality of border checkpoints 100 miles inside the United States. The notion that you have to stop and talk to these officers about your citizenship status. Meanwhile, there are sanctuary cities across the country. There are whole regions, whole states, whole cities that say we will not comply with border authorities. So the government can say they won't tell you anything. They won't tell federal immigration authorities about anyone's citizenship status. And the president will say some people who are here illegally, They get a pass. They can stay. In fact, the IRS is going to send them checks. But if you're a U.S. citizen, you pull up into one of these things and you don't want to talk, they'll scream at you, shatter your windshield, drag you out of the car, and lock you up. And apparently some juries will even say, yeah, that's right, put him in jail. Put him in prison for this. So this is just the completely ridiculous, unprincipled nature of border enforcement now. If you're a citizen, you better comply. If you're a non-citizen, we'll find a carve-out for you.
Buck Sexton, The Blaze Radio Network.
This is the Buck Sexton Show.
All right, Team Buck, the broad voice is open. Our lines here are ready for your calls. 888-900-3393. Plenty of room now, so please do give us a ring. We have Mark in Albany on the line. Mark, you're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Hey, Buck. First of all, I own a trucking company. I am a driver. I am currently driving safely, though.
Hands-free, right? Hands-free.
Hands-free, of course. It's a $2,300 fine for holding something to my ear. It's actually a $2,300 fine to hold it in your hand. Anyway, I won't even get into how stupid that law is. Driving is a privilege. It's not a right. You don't have a right to drive a big rig. You can't just suddenly grab one at age 16 and drive one without any kind of government override. Now, if this guy was walking, yes, you have a constitutional right to walk. That is your right. Those are your legs. This is America. You're free. But driving a big rig is a privilege. And first of all, it's an administrative privilege. You don't have a court order giving you a right to drive a big rig. So when the executive branch gives you something without the judicial branch, the executive branch can also take it away without the judicial branch. Now, you can appeal to the judicial branch to override it, but we'll get into that later. So when this guy starts messing around, they have a right to pull you over at any time and check your privilege status. They have a right to inspect your vehicle. I've had dogs in my truck. I've had to sit and wait as they tear my entire truck apart and go through my trash and everything.
You don't think there's some Fourth Amendment implications when you're 100 miles from an actual U.S. border or port of entry and somebody can just pull you aside, go through everything? And I mean, that to me does raise some flags about probable cause or reasonable suspicion, rather, and search and seizure. I mean, you don't see that as an issue at all? I'm sort of surprised, to be honest, Mark. I would figure you'd be annoyed by that.
I make $500,000 a year. You can do whatever you want to me. I really don't care. What I get from the government versus what the government asked me to give up, I knew this getting in. I knew exactly what was going to happen. I would give up my right to privacy in my big rig. It varies.
Okay, but now, Mark, to be fair, first of all, apparently I need to get into the trucking business. And second of all, what if you're a private? I mean, this guy's a, I know this is a truck driver. What if you're a private citizen and you go through the same process? You're just driving along in your car on well inside of U.S. soil, and you have to go through a series of questions. I mean, I think there's a fair point to ask here. First of all, the federal government is unserious about immigration violations and immigration policy in mm-hmm. many, many cases. But they're going to set up interior checkpoints. I mean, the only reason they're doing this, it seems to me, is in the hopes that not that they're going to catch illegals, but they're going to catch drugs, because catching drugs is a huge component of the ever expanding federal bureaucracy. Right. You catch drugs. Good. Now you need more money. You can catch even more drugs because people are going to be safer if you catch enough drugs. I mean, I think that's ridiculous. But I mean, Mark, I understand that you're happy that you've been able to be successful in this and you're willing to trade off that right. But can't you see there's some, look, if it were me, I'd say, yes, I'm a U.S. citizen, you know, officer or whatever. Can I go about my day? Right. I just wouldn't want to deal with it. But I do think, you know, what if they're all of a sudden waiting for people at bus stops and saying, you know, are you? Well, what's so weird is there are other contexts where you're not allowed to ask citizenship status, right? I mean, there are state officials who are told they can't ask citizenship. I mean, the Obama administration sues the state of Arizona for trying to help the federal government enforce federal immigration law. So, I mean, that's the disconnect. That's what really upsets me about this. Is it's one thing if you're actually enforcing immigration law across the board, but this is just for show, and I think it's really just drug related. It's like an extension of the DEA.
The big rigs really do have an advantage over anything. We can carry 100 people in the back if we want to pack them in. And in the company I used to work for back when I was working for somebody, there's an aerodynamic fiberglass dome above the truck that helps us with just aerodynamics. There were 5 Mexicans found in there. And when they pulled somebody over there, they happened to see a foot sticking out. That's what happens. It's so easy to hide drugs on the outside of a truck with just a magnet, or inside the truck. It's just a huge void. I can't even go to some of the.
How many of these have you been through? Some of these as a trucker, have you been through some of these
Absolutely.
Interior Border Patrol checkpoints yourself? And how quickly, if you comply, how quickly can you get through this process?
Faster than your call screening process. You're done in the blink of an eye. It's like, are you a U.S. citizen? Yes, I am. Okay, thank you very much. That's it.
Understand is, what if you say you're not a U.S. citizen? I mean, sorry, forget that question. What I understand is, who's going to say they're not a U.S. citizen? I mean, this seems to me as stupid as the airports asking you, did you pack your bags yourself? And it's like, yeah, you know, Ahmed, the international terrorist extraordinaire, is going to say, no, I did not pack my bag myself. I mean, it's ridiculous, right? What is this supposed to prove? Like, who are they really trying to catch?
Buck, I found out the hard way that you don't joke around with that subject at the airport. I said an Iraqi packed my bag back right after the first Gulf War. Oh, I was detained and frisked. But anyway.
I would not do that. They have no sense of humor in any of these contexts, and understandably so. But all right, well, Mark, it's interesting to have a trucker call in who's supportive of these interior checkpoints. I find them troubling, because I think, I mean, if it's 100 miles, why not 500? Why not 1,000 miles from any U.S. border? And at that point, it's like, well, you have Border Patrol checkpoints in your local neighborhood asking if you're a citizen. But they're not really – thank you for calling in, Mark. Appreciate it. This is the thing. They're not really trying to find illegals. I mean, you can be an illegal and go protest on the lawn in D.C. You know, you can say, oh, well, you know, I'm an illegal and I want status. And they're not rounding people up. It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, you're either serious about enforcement and immigration laws or you're not. And the federal government's just fundamentally not. Yeah, they catch people at the border, but now their orders, as I understand it, are to catch people. And if they catch them at the border, they just turn them back around. You know, try again another day. And they do. It's just insane. I mean, why even go through this? Imagine this. You pull up. Okay, so you say, yeah, I'm a U.S. citizen. Well, if you have an accent and come from an area known for a fair amount of illegal crossings, can they then think that you're lying? I mean, no, of course, that would be discrimination. That would be profiling. So they just say yes, right? I don't understand how this is supposed to actually stop anyone from doing anything, unless you are really dumb and pull up to one of these checkpoints and say, I don't know. I mean, no, I don't want you to look in my trunk and see the huge bales of marijuana that are there. I mean, unless you do something like that, how are you going to get caught? So what's the purpose? It just seems like harassment, and it seems like Border Patrol trying to seem like they're doing more than they are. I don't know. And look, any Border Patrol out there, if you're listening, please do call in. Tell me I'm wrong on this one. It just seems preposterous to me. And I mean, I know for a fact that some of the airport security stuff is absolutely ridiculous. Did you pack your bag yourself? Yeah, dude, I packed my bag myself. If I were a terrorist, though, I don't think I would answer that question honestly if there was something illicit in my bag. But then they say, oh, no, but they're taught to read body language and signals. Yeah, right. When was the last time you were in an airport? You think they're reading body language and looking for rapid eye movement? I don't think so. The wires just got crossed there, and that was not English what was coming out of my mouth. I wanted to get to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act in Indiana and such, and I don't have as much time as I had hoped here, so maybe I'll just sort of touch on it, but let me just say that there's now another capital that has this as a big issue. You've got Arkansas joining Indiana with bills on religious freedom. And what's interesting is that the Indiana law is still being completely misreported, right? The people that are talking about it are not giving an honest description of what's really happening with it, which I think is pretty fascinating that the media can get away with this. And the only real differences between the Indiana law and the federal law that's been on the books for 20 some odd years now is that the Indiana law explicitly points out that you can be a corporate person exercising religious freedom. And also, as I've said earlier in the week, it explicitly protects individuals from other individuals in lawsuits. Now, here's part of the key point, and I just fell into a trap there myself. It doesn't protect anyone from anything, really. It means that you can raise as a defense in court and can be considered as a defense, right, in court. You know, there are some cases where, you know, for example, times when federal trespass law, even if you say, well, I didn't know I was on federal property, they'll go ahead and they'll prosecute you anyway because they have a strict liability standard, which, by the way, strict liability standards, giant doorway to tyranny, horrible laws almost all cases, because you have to have mens rea, you have to have a criminal mindset in order to be a criminal. And that's true of every single criminal statute, short of reckless or indifferent behavior. That's the way it should be. Nonetheless, I didn't get too deep into this. I'll have to return to the RFRA situation here in just a second. 888-900-3393. Team Buck, a lot more show coming your way. Don't go anywhere. Light at the Broad Voice lines. Send me some tweets at Buck Sexton. And please go to Facebook.com/Buck Sexton. I'm getting into the comment sections there every day. We're talking back and forth. Let's keep it going. Back in a minute.
Buck Sexton will be right back.
The Blaze Radio Network. Buck Sexton.
I know there's been a lot of bad reporting on it this week, so let's just do a quick and dirty on the reality of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Team Buck, just join me here as we work through quickly what we need to know about this. First of all, you've got people who are completely misrepresenting what the law is, what it would possibly do, and hasn't done very successfully, by the way, in the few cases where it has been deployed elsewhere. But all this says is that for both persons and corporations, there is the possibility of raising as a defense against either a private party or the state, literally the state government, that there is some religious, they desire some religious exemption from activity that they are otherwise perhaps compelled to engage in. And you have that. That's all it says. There's a companion federal law that's been on the books for 20 years. There are 19 other states that have in addition to Indiana that have these laws on the books already. So the mountain, the avalanche of legislation, of Religious Freedom Restoration Act type laws, is a fait accompli. It's already done. There's no reason to, we're litigating this now. It's already been litigated. This has been existing for quite some time. There hasn't been also a tidal wave of discrimination that has come out of this, because the fact of the matter is that the big concern here, which is that somebody may have to make, or somebody may be in a position where they're having to sell a wedding cake, or the better example, actually, not people are going to sell a cake to anyone who walks into a store, okay? But generally speaking, if it's someone who has to partake in a ceremony that is against their religious belief, say be a photographer at a gay wedding, should they have to do that? That's what's at issue here. And people on different sides of that can have different positions, and it seems that there are some competing goods at work there. You know where I stand on this. I've been saying all week, I tend to always side with liberty whenever possible. But at least let's be clear about what's really happening here. You've got Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, essentially saying there should be a boycott of Indiana. Hashtag boycott Indiana has been lighting up the Twitter sphere and all over social media over the past few days. And as I sit here with Apple products, I have to say, Tim Cook, maybe a product genius, a visionary, and all the rest of it, but apparently doesn't use the Google very much, because not very aware of what the law says in Indiana or what the law is across the country when it comes to this issue. Also, by the way, there seems to be a total lack of interest in the fact that Religious Freedom Restoration Act laws typically have been used to defend the rights of religious minorities in different practices. They've protected Muslims, Hindus, Native Americans, and others who are not in some big, powerful group, but who have some religious practice that may. And this, of course, then takes us all the way back to whether you can have peyote as part of a religious ceremony. Well, no, the government had a compelling interest, and under strict scrutiny, they could say, no, we can't allow people to do illegal drugs. Sorry. If it's illegal for everyone, it's illegal for you, even despite your religion. But there are other exemptions that can be made. For example, forcing a Muslim prisoner to shave his beard. Is that really necessary? Is that absolutely necessary? Is there any other? And the courts have recently said, no, it's not completely necessary. So this law that they think is just for hate mongers and bigots has actually been used to protect minorities at many times in the past, and has not resulted in massive and widespread discrimination against homosexuals or anyone else, for that matter. But you see the facts, the history, the truth of the law and the intentions behind it don't really matter when you have activists who have an absolutist agenda on this issue, coupled with people who just want to hashtag seem really cool, hashtag stand up in front of their friends and show how brave they are. You know, when you speak to an audience that's only going to applaud your position, you're not being brave. Okay, that's not an issue that you should then walk around chin wagging and acting like you're some sort of hero for. The Indiana law here is it's been made into much ado about nothing, really, by the left. There's no big shock here. This is not the first time this has come up. And now, of course, they're going back and trying to redraft and clarify. But see, the problem with Governor Pence and others who have decided they're going to try to cave to this pressure is, there's no clarification here. People want to make sure that there is no legal grounds, no legal standing for any religious person or religious body to make distinctions and make decisions about the kinds of practices they will engage in, particularly when it comes to the gay rights movement. That's it. That's what they want.
Buck Sexton
on the Blaze Radio Network.
Spreading freedom across the nation. This is
the Buck Sexton Show.
All right, Team Buck, thank you so much for staying with me into hour two. You notice we haven't yet gotten into the latest craziness in the Middle East. We've got the Iran negotiations, but also a lot of fighting and bloodshed on the ground, including Iran and Shia militia capture of Tikrit, at least most of Tikrit, from Islamic State militants. Well, to help us work through this now, backed by popular demand of some Team Buck requests here, we have Michael Weiss. He's the author of ISIS, Inside the Army of Terror, which I just read today, the New York Times says, I believe, is the most detailed and serious account of ISIS yet. Michael, thank you so much for calling in.
Sure. Thanks for having me on again.
All right. So what do you think about happenings in let's start with Tikrit, then we'll sort of expand it out. What do you think about these Shia militias being used as the mullah's army on the ground, taking back from the Islamic State that which they had previously conquered?
Yeah, I think you and I agree about this. This is a disaster in the long term. Short term, it's nice to see ISIS being defeated. But these militia groups, as I wrote in Foreign Policy with Mike Pregent, are guilty of ISIS-like atrocities. They have beheaded people. They have burnt down entire villages surrounding the town of Amerli, which was retaken last October. They're actually going around rounding up their fellow Shia and torturing them because they believe that they might actually be Sunnis who are collaborating with ISIS. So, you know, the question is the cure as bad, or if maybe not worse than the disease, but you know, going to plunge Iraq into another period of sectarian civil conflict? I think the answer is yes. A lot of Sunnis in Iraq are, you know, not sympathetic to ISIS or their ideology. I mean, if there's actually a quite powerful, albeit muted and under-reported resistance effort inside Mosul. The problem is, who are they going to rise up? On whose behalf will they be rising up against ISIS? They're not going to do it on behalf of Tehran. And that's sort of how we see it in Iraq today. So the recent operation in Tikrit, you know, the militias essentially waged this campaign a month ago without a buyer leave from Washington or consultations with CENTCOM. Then the campaign stalled. And just to put this in perspective, we're talking about, I've seen estimates anywhere from 24,000 to 30,000 pro-government forces, of which 20,000, you know, were said to be militiamen. These guys were fighting against 400 to 750 ISIS militants who held their ground for 3 weeks. The campaign stalled. Then Baghdad realized, you know, it was sort of lost in its own sort of folly of a military effort. So it requested airstrikes. U.S. airstrikes came in, and the U.S. said, well, we don't want the militias to lead this charge anymore. So make sure that there are Iraqi federal police and Iraqi security forces that are, you know, spearheading the effort. What I see now is essentially a very sophisticated propaganda effort to paint this as the state that is doing it. It's not. It's Hashd al-Shaabi. It's still the militia groups. They never really left. They temporarily boycotted the operation because of U.S. involvement, but they didn't withdraw from the battlefield. They just kind of waited in to see what would happen. But
what do you think? Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, the people who are essentially in control of the militia consortium known as the Popular Mobilization Forces, Hadi al-Amri, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, both of them are Iranian spies. Both of them answer to Qasem Soleimani. So this is really very much an Iranian victory.
That's a perfect transition. Michael, I wanted to ask, what do you think Soleimani's, what's his strategy here from, you know, at this point on? Where is he trying to take this? I mean, where do you see Iranian influence going at this point? I don't think they can count on Shia militia to try to take Mosul, for example, but what do you think the Iranians are hoping they can get out of all this?
Well, they're actually in a tough spot. You know, they're depicting this as sort of their grand triumph, their takeover of Iraq, their takeover of Yemen and the rest of it. But in actuality, the Quds force and their clients or proxies all throughout the Middle East have been suffering some pretty tactical losses. Soleimani's effort to push back against Syrian rebels in southern Syria failed. And, you know, for that campaign, he brought in Afghan Shia and, you know, Hezbollah. Hezbollah and the IRGC are not doing so well in Syria at the moment. And, you know, obviously Assad's forces in Idlib just lost the city, mostly to Jabhat al-Nusra, but other Islamist groups as well. In Iraq, look, they've bitten off more than they can chew. You're quite right. They're not going to be able to take Mosul. Mosul is a city of 1 to 2 million people, the second most populous city in Iraq. It's hard to say how many are still left because there's a huge refugee exodus, or there was, beginning in last June when ISIS blew in. And also Soleimani is kind of walking this knife edge, isn't he, of a kind of tacit de facto alliance with the United States, but at the same time, you know, fulminations and you know, no let up in the hatred for great Satan. So can Iran flush out ISIS without America's help? No. Can Iran flush out ISIS with America's help? I don't think they can. Again, you need Sunnis to fight Sunni jihadis. And so that, you know, you've seen some token numbers of Sunni tribesmen that are joining up with these militias. But what you don't see is anything approaching a groundswell, nothing like the awakening from the 2006 to 2008.
Right. I think that the Islamic State learned from the previous problems facing Al-Qaeda in Iraq. I know you and I have talked this before, and they recognize don't even leave anyone in a position to perhaps rise up against you. Even at the slightest inclination or the slightest concern, they can execute people. And that's what they've been doing in some of the tribal areas. But I want to ask you for your, you know, ISIS was, and I know when I was bumping into you at CNN with some frequency, ISIS was just the news story day in and day out. Everyone's talking about it. It has faded away for a variety of reasons from as a news story, but by no means as an organization. So I just wanted to give you the floor here to bring us up to speed on where are they gaining, where are they losing? I mean, what's the sort of ISIS scorecard as of today? Because people haven't really heard that much about it in recent weeks.
Yeah, I mean, look, they're losing tactical ground in Iraq. Have they lost strategically in Iraq? Well, no. If you look at the current lay of the land, just any map, the Institute for the Study of War has a weekly Iraq update, and they put out some very good sort of optics on the battlefield. They're still in control of about one-third of the country. So the Kurds have moved in. They've creeped over the Green Line and taken Kirkuk, and you know they're also terrified of the Shia militias because that's the next impending conflict. It's going to be Iran versus the Kurds. And you know the loss of Tikrit is a symbolic victory for Iraq and Iran. But does that mean they're going to you know hit Mosul anytime soon? No, I think that campaign is months, if not even longer, away. In Syria, and they've actually been making gains. There's this news out today. I haven't really looked into it too deeply because I've been doing other things. But that ISIS is now in Yarmouk, the Palestinian refugee camp in Damascus. That is terrifying, not just because it means that a lot of Palestinian refugees are going to suffer, but that is right into the heart of the capital there. And it's true that ISIS has had a presence in Damascus, although it hasn't been a very robust or numerically strong one, but that may change. They are also in Hama. They're still in very much the suburbs of Aleppo, Deir Zor, Hasaka. They've taken ground. So they were pushed out of Kobani and many of the outlying villages, mostly by the YPG Kurdish militias. But they're still entrenched. In Syria, they're gaining ground. Look, and here's what sort of worries me in the long term. Metaphorically speaking, with the stroke of a pen, they gained 20,000 square miles of terrain in West Africa when Boko Haram pledged allegiance to Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and he accepted. They are spreading like a cancer throughout the region. Obviously, they've now set up shop in Yemen. We've seen with the beheading of the Egyptian cops in Libya, they have a presence there. They're very good at recruiting away from al-Qaeda franchises, jihadis who feel like, you know, Zawahiri's concern is sort of a busted flush at this point. He's a has-been and a sellout. Let's cast our lot with the going jihadi movement. I don't see, I mean, if you're asking me, are we winning? Is ISIS losing? I think the answer is no, they're not losing. But they have suffered military defeats, as you would expect them to do when they go up against the United States. But, you know, again, I've always said, you know, the U.S. is engaged in this kind of information warfare against ISIS, how to push back against their propaganda. The problem is, U.S. foreign policy is the greatest asset to ISIS's propaganda, because this goes back a decade to Zarqawi. What was his main conceit? It was this crusader Jewish Rafida conspiracy, the United States and Iran, dispossessing, murdering, ethnically cleansing the Sunnis. Well, at the time, that sounded a little hysterical and conspiratorial. Today, it sounds less so to Sunnis because, again, they do see U.S.
Because we're Iran's Air Force into Crete, yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, this is, you are seeing now, I think, a collective nervous breakdown on the part of Sunni Muslim countries in the region or Sunni-led countries in the region. This is why the Gulf states are chewing the carpet in paroxysms of anxiety in this area about this Iran deal, because they see it, and even though the Obama administration denies it, they see this as not about a nuclear deal with Iran. They see this as about rapprochement with the Islamic Republic in an effort maybe to replace the relationship we have with Saudi Arabia with one with Iran.
Right. You know, it seems pretty clear that there's no expectation that there'll be a change in Iranian behavior as a result of a nuclear deal, because any change in behavior is not part of the negotiation.
This is sort of Alice in Wonderland thinking, you know. I mean, you taking the anti-Americanism out of Khomeinism leaves nothing of Khomeinism left, you know. So you can't have the Islamic Republic as it currently exists without the anti-American. And we're seeing this now. There's a very good piece I just read in the New York Times about, hey, everyone thought we were inches away from a deal over the nuclear stuff. And in fact, they're putting down these new, you know, kind of intransigent lines and conditions. And, you know, there's this deep abiding suspicion of the United States, and the Supreme Leader does not want to budge. Well, exactly, because that's the system. That is the nature of the regime. And, you know,
right. Well, I think we get a sense of that when they're yelling, literally yelling death to America the same day publicly. Yeah. And they're saying death to America as John Kerry's coming out saying we're very close to a deal.
Yeah. And, you know, unfortunately, I think, you know, America has suffered from in the post 9/11 period, not just a kind of fetish of counterterrorism. And counterterrorism is not a field anymore. It's more like an industry. And with many industries, you know, you get too close to your subject and there's a lot of financial gain to be made from, you know, resorting to drones and JSOC raids and leaving out the politics, right? Politics is all, especially in the Middle East. So people who go around saying, well, why do we care? Iran doesn't threaten us and Shia militias don't threaten us. First of all, Shia militias do threaten us. They have said they want to shoot down U.S. warplanes. They accuse the United States of having invented ISIS and now backing it militarily and financially. So this is not a concern to be taken lightly. Qatif Hezbollah, or the Hezbollah Brigade in Iraq, they are a U.S.-designated terrorist organization, the only Shia militia to be so. And they have said, we would love to nothing more than to take down an American cargo plane. So what happens if they do that? You know, it doesn't mean they have to strike in the American homeland.
Right. Well, these same militias, and I've been telling everyone on the show this for weeks now, these same militias went out of their way to explicitly target U.S. personnel to just kill, to kill them with EFPs so that it would be harder for us to put down the sectarian civil war happening in Iraq. And this was this is now 2007, 2008.
And this is, I think this is the sort of fatuousness of America's line that we have a common interest with Iran and Iraq. We do not. They want to defeat the Islamic State, but replace it with their Islamic state or their, you know, export the Islamic revolution. America wants, in theory, a democratic, non-sectarian, you know, country with its own sovereignty. Iran wants nothing of the kind. And yes, you're quite right. 20% of U.S. casualties during the occupation and war were sustained through essentially a dirty war conducted by Iran and its proxies on the ground. There's a famous, in the Dexter Filkins piece on Qasem Soleimani, which is one of the best pieces of journalism I've read. There's a line there about, I think it was Jalal Talabani, the Kurdish leader who showed David Petraeus text messages alleging that it was from Soleimani saying this was during the Second Lebanese War in 2006. And Soleimani told the U.S. commander of forces in Iraq, I hope you're enjoying a little vacation I've been giving you and your boys. I've been tied up in Beirut for the last few weeks. I mean, this is an evil man. This is a man who wants to kill Americans. This is a man who wants to hurt the United States and its interests. And we're treating him as though he's the Patton or the Eisenhower of this campaign. I mean, there's been – Iranian state media love this. There have been rumors – probably bogus.
Right.
But it just gives you a sense
if we take a slightly longer view, Michael, it seems pretty clear to me that given how, you know, people were talking about Iranian influence in Iraq, and it was sort of in vogue even in 2008 and 2009. People say, oh, well, we've handed Iran to Iraq, or rather Iraq to Iran. Well, if you thought that was true then, you must really think it's true now. I think it's really we've crossed the point of no return, because there's no way that you're going to be able to settle the sectarianism when you have the government actively using Shia militias as essentially auxiliary forces at the direction of Iran, with, as you say, yes, Qasem Soleimani running around acting like he's the Iraqi equivalent of Rommel or whoever.
Right, exactly. And, you know, look, unfortunately, the people that are running U.S. policy, both in and out of Iraq, are the ones who are saying, oh, you know, Maliki, he's our guy. He's not an Iranian stooge. We can work with him. I mean, Joe Biden should be remembered for many things, but two quotes in particular. Number one, he said, I'll bet my vice presidency that Maliki signed the Status of Forces Agreement. Well, you notice he's still vice president and we have no sofa. Number two, when Maliki essentially stole the Iraqi election in 2010 and the U.S. had to make a decision of which horse they were going to back, Alawi, who was the interim prime minister, secular Shia but liked by many Sunnis, or Maliki, they went with Maliki. And Joe Biden is even on record, as is in The Endgame, which is the best history book of the Iraq War, saying Maliki hates the goddamn Sunnis. Well, then why did the United States back him? Because that is what has led to this crisis. That is how ISIS gained purchase in Iraq, or how it came back into power.
In moments of frustration, Michael, in moments of absolute frustration, I remember hearing people in the government say, you know, maybe when dealing with AQI and the Sunni insurgency, maybe we should just back the Shia. Maybe this is a fool's errand. They didn't mean it, but people would sort of just would let that go. That's actually what's happening right now. That is the de facto policy on the ground in Iraq.
There's no getting around the fact that Iraq is a Shia majority country. But here's the thing: most Iraqi Shias do not want to be in a state of vassalage to Iran. You know, they want their independence. And you know, a lot of them, even those who back the militias and now the IRGC, they say quite rightly, you know, America was not here for us. Iran came and rescued us from the soup. America was not here. They abandoned this country. They withdrew militarily. You know, they kept Maliki going. So this is what you get. And I have to be honest with you, I'm somewhat sympathetic to that line of argument, because it is true. We created this mess. And then when it looked like it was sort of getting a little bit better, actually a lot better, if you look at the metrics, I mean, kinetic activities throughout the country were down precipitously after both the awakening and then the surge. And by 2010, the AQI leadership was decimated. But the reason that they came back with a bullet is because the Sunnis felt completely politically disenfranchised and marginalized.
Right. The political project failed. Michael, I've actually, the machine's going to cut me off, but ISIS Inside the Army of Terror is his book. Michael Weiss is the author. Michael, thank you so much for calling in. Great as always. Talk to you again soon. All right, guys, we'll be back in just a minute.
888-900-3393.
You're on the Buck Sexton Show.
Only on the Blaze Radio Network.
Get your Team Buck t-shirt at theblaze.com.
All right, Team Buck, the broad voice is open. We can take some calls. 888-900-3393. We have Jared in New Mexico on the line. Jared, you are on the Buck Sexton Show.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for calling.
Yes, sir. I was calling. I live in New Mexico, like you said, and there's actually a Border Patrol checkpoint here, and I was actually on a jury trial for someone that was supposedly trafficking drugs through that checkpoint. And whenever it came to jury trial, he had actually been held in jail for quite some time. And whenever it came to jury trial, their evidence was the drugs were found in the trash can of the Greyhound bus, and their reason for suspecting him was his suitcase didn't have enough clothes in it, therefore the drugs were his.
That was it?
That was it.
They got a conviction on that?
No, it ended up in a hung jury.
That's unbelievable. You're on a jury. You're on the jury for a trial, and they find drugs in a trash can of a bus, and because somebody doesn't have that much luggage, they think that's beyond a reasonable doubt. See, this is, I'm sorry, you know, in a lot of cases, especially with the drug stuff, law enforcement just gets away with way too much. I'm sorry. And I've worked with them and I love them and I got them in my family. But on drug issues, we're just so desperate to lock people up for drug stuff. Go ahead, Jared.
And it was actually prosecuted by the county department. The Border Patrol.
You know what, Jared, hold. Can you hold through the break, Jared? Because we're about to go into a break, and I can't stop the Soros machine here. But can you hold for a minute? We'll take this on the other side.
Yes, sir.
Hold on the line. We'll be right back with Jared on what happened at this trial in New Mexico.
You're listening to Buck Sexton, only on the Blaze Radio Network. The Buck Sexton Show.
All right, Team Buck. So we're talking about some Border Patrol issues, interior checkpoints. We have Jared on the line who was dealing with a Border Patrol issue as a juror on a case. Jared, I just didn't want to cut you off there. So finish up. So you were saying that there's an individual, was he a U.S. citizen?
Yes.
He's a U.S. citizen, and the only evidence, and you were on the jury, so you would know, the only evidence they had to present against this guy was that he had a light, you know, his suitcase didn't have that much stuff in it, and they found, how much drugs are we talking about here?
If I remember, I want to say it was 10 pounds.
Okay, so it was a lot of drugs. It wasn't like they found a baggie. Okay, so they've got 10 pounds. Was it marijuana or something, or what was it?
It was marijuana.
10 pounds of marijuana. Okay. So they're looking for a trafficker, and they say this guy's luggage is light. Now, you see, this is where I start to get really uncomfortable, because I can understand most people would say, okay, looks suspicious. Look suspicious is not enough under U.S. criminal code and U.S. jurisprudence in the court system. That's not enough to take away someone's freedom for decades, perhaps even life, when you're talking about drug trafficking.
And what even made it worse was the suitcase was not even produced as evidence to even see if that amount of drugs would fit into the suitcase in question.
So they had really had nothing on him other than he didn't have that much in his suitcase. That was the most they were presenting as evidence.
That was, and he was a convicted felon. He had a prior charge on him.
Okay, so totally totally circumstantial and priors, and they go for this guy. Can I ask you, what was it like? You said it was a hung jury. What were the other jurors thinking? I mean, they just figured, he looks bad to me. Let's just put him in jail. Because, you know, the standard is beyond a reasonable doubt, and you don't have that much stuff in your luggage is not beyond a reasonable doubt. So what were they? Well, were they just sort of going along with what the prosecutors wanted?
Well, I think, and during this, in New Mexico, you're on jury trial for 6 months. And then not only this trial, but all trials, it amazed me how many people are convinced that the police do not arrest innocent people.
I hear that from you, Jared, and it shakes me, man, because I know that's the case too. People are always, you're always led to believe that, you know, juries are going to side with their fellow civilians, and that juries are looking for any police impropriety. That is not how it works. Usually they're like, yeah, it looks guilty to me. Lock him up.
Yeah, and that's what I found the most troubling, not only in this trial but all trials. You know, and I do have family in law enforcement. I have two brothers that are in law enforcement, but you know, it comes down to, well, I got to put myself in that situation. If I'm on the Greyhound bus, you know, and maybe I don't have enough in my suitcase, do I really feel like I that's a good reason to put me in jail for trafficking drugs?
Right. And do you agree, by the way, with the assessment, having dealt with some of this, that it seems to me they pretend they're looking for illegals at these checkpoints. They're actually looking for drugs. They're not looking for illegals, because all you have to do is say that you're here legally. They're not asking for any. They don't expect you to have your passport on you. So you can't prove it right then and there. So what difference, yeah. How are they supposed to know? It seems to me they're just looking for drugs.
Yeah. And then, exactly, looking for drugs. And another thing is President Obama, authorized another national monument in southern New Mexico here. Well, that clears up the roads. You can't drive in there. Law enforcement, even the local county law enforcement, are like, well, we can't do our job as good now. We can't get into this area to patrol it anymore because now it's a national monument. So that locks up a lot of the land, and that restrains the law enforcement from being able to do their job more, and it gives more of a pipeline into the country as far as I can see.
All right. Jared, thank you for staying with us, and thank you for holding. Appreciate you sharing your perspective on this stuff. Whew, man, it's so troubling. This is also, this reminds me of the notion that you hear more and more. Well, I have nothing to hide, so I don't need the Fourth Amendment. Or I have nothing to hide, so, you know, the government should be able to have backdoors into my electronic devices, should be able to retain and then analyze and surf through all of my digital footprint whenever it feels like it, for whatever reason it chooses. This is bad stuff. It's really part of, for me, it's the sort of corruption of the ethos of the sort of very basic principles and ethos of being a free citizen in a free society that values liberty, and for which liberty is a first principle. And we're just moving away from that now. You know, we're all sort of accepting treatment more along the lines of livestock. It's like, just don't abuse us, but feed us and give us a warm place to be, and hopefully, you know, I won't get pulled out and slaughtered for the meat, so you know, they'll just keep me here, and I'll just get milked over time via the IRS. We really are being turned into a nation of what I used to call moo cows when I was a kid. I've nothing to hide. Oh, the drug war is a good thing. You know, this is, just imagine this for a second. You've got people who are facing absolutely insane sentences for conspiracy. They didn't even get there. They didn't necessarily even get any drugs or give any drugs to anyone, but for conspiracy to distribute drugs in some quantity or another. And they're facing unbelievable prison sentences, you know, and President Obama has finally done some commutations of sentences and, you know, 22 of them now. And they're releasing, for example, you have this guy, they've released the names and the sentences from these 22 commutations. And the president's been particularly stingy with pardons. Remember, a commutation is lessening the sentence. A pardon is vacating the sentence. So not only are you free, or if you've already served your sentence, this also applies. It's like the charge never happened. It's like it's just wiped from the record. A presidential pardon removes it. You know, you are essentially given a second chance, a real second chance, which if you serve your sentence now, by the way, there is no second chance. You're basically done. You lose rights. You can't get a job. And that's the way our society treats even nonviolent offenders. You know, so once you're a convicted felon, and you can be a convicted felon for check fraud, you basically have no place in American society anymore. It's very, very hard for you. And it's always interesting to me that liberals who, leftists who cry and whine all the time about the plight of minorities do nothing really meaningful on prison reform, do nothing on reforming government's power to imprison people because they like government power. They like a huge apparatus. They like the government being able to essentially use the force, and use law to enact every kind of policy imaginable. So they want the Leviathan, don't you see? They don't want to constrain it. They just want to control it. I actually want a little itty-bitty Leviathan. I want a Leviathan that we don't have to worry about, directed towards securing our borders and protecting us from enemies abroad and leaving us alone as much as humanly possible. Maybe it sounds like a crazy pipe dream now, but I'm pretty sure that's what the founders intended, and I'm pretty sure it would be possible if we just had a different sense of ourselves in this country. But we're losing it. I'm telling you, we are losing it day after day. I just want to pull my hair. Well, I'm not going to pull my hair out. Come on, let's not get crazy. I just want to punch through a window whenever I hear people say, well, I have nothing to hide. You know, this is sort of like the Bill and Ted. I was watching that movie last night for no good reason. It was on Netflix. This is the Bill and Ted School of Jurisprudence. I mean, it's like I don't have a problem. So, like, why not just give up all my rights, bruh? It's not a good idea. But back to these commutations, 22 of them from President Obama. And, for example, you've got an individual here, conspiracy to distribute cocaine, 246 months imprisonment, 10 years supervised release. Conspiracy to distribute crack from the Southern District of Florida. This is a woman named Teresa Brown. Life imprisonment. Life. She's going to jail for the rest of her life. Some of these individuals, by the way, were first-time offenders. Conspiracy to possess with intent to distribute cocaine. This was in Tallahassee, Florida. Life imprisonment. Conspiracy to possess methamphetamine with intent to distribute. Life imprisonment. That was in Kansas for Samuel Edmondson. You look at this, and these are all drug offenses. And now I'm not saying that these people should face no sanction whatsoever, and that we should allow people to distribute methamphetamine on the streets. I do think this notion, by the way, that just because something has ever been considered a Schedule One controlled substance and under the Controlled Substances Act, that can never be changed. Like, that's more written in stone than the Ten Commandments, my friends. If you listen to the statists, you know, this drug is really bad. And as you know, you look at the studies of marijuana versus alcohol use, which is more dangerous for you when abused, which causes more fatalities. Anyway. But just because it's ever been on the list, they want to treat it like they're all equally dangerous. I mean, to treat cocaine as though it's equally dangerous to marijuana is based in no science and is insane. It's just based on essentially ignorance of the facts and really an anti-scientific, anti-substance bigotry, if you could call it that. You know, they just assume, oh, well, it's illegal. Let's just all treat them though they're the same. Now, this is crazy. I've told friends of mine and they never believe me because, you know, for example, in some of the tonier, fancier boarding schools, there's a lot of young people who will distribute their prescription drugs to each other, right? They'll just sort of, you know, they'll sell Xanax to each other. And this happens all the time. It happens in high schools across the country. And I'll tell them, well, just so you know, selling one prescription pill to someone is a felony. You sell one pill, and you get caught, and they decide to go ahead with the charges, you're a convicted felon. And that follows you around the rest of your life. For selling a Xanax to somebody? You must be joking. This is insane. No, this is actually the law. That the fact we were just talking about somebody who was on a jury trial for someone because of the state's belief, and it sounded very flimsy to me, that he was involved in trafficking marijuana. Okay, so you can get decades in prison for trafficking marijuana in New Mexico, but in Colorado you can open a store, sell the stuff, and the federal government leaves you alone. You cannot have both. You cannot have both positions. You cannot have the federal government. By the way, all state level drug laws are essentially companion laws to federal law because the federal government makes all the stuff illegal and state governments make all this stuff illegal, and they can prosecute you under either one. If they want to go federal, and I know this, I had friends who were on drug prosecution task forces, a job that I would never take and never be a part of, by the way, but that's just me. They would say that some days you go federal, some days you go state. If they went after you federal, man, you were in trouble. Just depended on how busy the federal prosecutors were that week. You're ruining people's lives, locking them up for decades, separating from their families. Just think about this. You know, you're separated from your spouse, or you're separated from finding a spouse. Just rotting away for decades at tremendous cost to the taxpayer, by the way, for conspiracy to traffic drugs. And as I said, these are, in many cases, first-time offenders. You're giving people 400 months in prison for conspiracy to distribute substances that in some states now, it's legal? Think about this. What is the moral, forget about the law for a second, what's the moral grounds for this? Well, based on what moral principle are you taking some people and locking them away for decades in one state for something that in another state is completely fine, the authorities are fine with it? And remember, you could say, oh no, buck federalism. No, don't pull that with me. The states are violating federal law and the feds are letting them get away with it in these states. So it's not an issue of just federal, oh, the states get to decide their own laws and there can't be a sort of universal standard. That's not true. The feds have set a universal standard, and in some states they enforce that universal standard, and in others they're now sort of complacent on it. I just think it's interesting that for all of Obama's rabble-rousing and for all of this Department of Justice's attempts to polarize along racial and ethnic lines and essentially to blame racism for the problems of the inner city and the problems of minority communities and never to come up with more productive ideas or solutions or programs than just blame the racists, President Obama's done very little indeed to actually reform the prison system in this country and the criminal code in this country, which is just a monstrosity. It is a national embarrassment. It really is. It is a national embarrassment. It is an embarrassment for us around the world. We lock people up for things that are crazy. Talk to somebody from the EU about the taxing authorities. They're like a nuisance. In other countries, the taxing authorities are like the people that come around and tell you you need to recycle or something. You can ignore them. Maybe they fine you. Here they can lock you up forever, make you a felon, spend 5-10 years in jail. And that's just the taxing authority. Don't even get me started on the drug enforcement authorities. It's a joke, but I guess people don't want to change it because we're all just terrified. Oh, we're so scared. Oh, gosh. What would happen? What would happen? People were able to sell marijuana legally. Oh, my gosh. We're all going to die. Back in a minute.
Taking intelligence to a whole new level. Buck Sexton.
The Blaze Radio Network.
Phone the Sexton Hotline. 888-900-3393.
I think on the issue of criminal justice and sentencing and the vast apparatus that keeps growing despite the fact that crime is plummeting, particularly violent crime is plummeting across the country overall. And yet we have more people with more agents of the government with more guns and more ability to look into your life and find ways to destroy you than ever before. Because, yeah, that's going to make us safer. They're just relying on petrified people across the country to think that they're going to be safer if they give away all their rights. And unfortunately, it's a pretty safe bet for the feds a lot of the time. I mentioned, by the way, on the show, we would be talking about a huge blackout in Turkey. This affected even Istanbul. They think it might have been a cyber attack. They're still looking into it. They haven't ruled out terrorism, but it was a massive blackout across the country that affected even flights and airports and mass transit systems. Just goes to show you that even in a major country with a pretty modern infrastructure, bad things can happen and blackouts can come. So I'll keep an eye on that, and if we can, we'll hit it tomorrow. In the meantime, everybody, remember, no matter what, shields high.
The Buck Sexton Show on the Blaze Radio Network.